Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
My name is Ben. I'm the student ministries pastor here, and thank you. While the prayer was being said about why Kim was praying that God would give Ben a special word, I was wondering if I'd hear a lot of feet start to skitter out. Like, oh, the youth pastor is preaching. Yeah. I'd like to begin off with a story that has nothing to do with my message this morning. I have two kids. And their names are Normandy and Baxter. And this morning, they share a room. And this morning, Normandy cries out, "Daddy, Daddy!" Like four, I don't know. It's sometime between 4 and 5 in the morning. And of course, I'm sort of jolted awake. And of course, I was dreaming about the sermon that I was going to give. And, so I go into her room, and I'm like, oh, quiet her down before Baxter wakes up. Which inevitably happens. And I said, "What's wrong, honey?" And she said, "Oh, Daddy, I had a bad dream. I dreamed that you bought me ice cream and that I dropped it on the floor. And then you got me another one and I dropped that one on the floor. And you didn't get me any more ice cream." That's all she said. And I was like, "Oh, honey." So I brought her into bed with me. So I've been up since 4. If you have kids and you made it here, I feel you. Yeah, I feel you. I'm glad you made it. But I made it, you made it, we're all here. Let's actually talk about Jesus. Matthew chapter 14 is where we're at. If you have a Bible, you can turn there or you can look it up. Whatever way you do it, Matthew chapter 14 is where we're at. And last week, we were introduced to this shift in the gospel account of Matthew. And up to this point, Jesus' ministry had been a public declaration that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. It was very public. And part of this declaration included sending out his disciples to perform miracles and warn people of the coming kingdom. And the results were, frankly, mixed. Sometimes they were quite disappointing. His disciples found the crowds to be fickle and unresponsive at times. His disciples they got ridiculed by the Jewish leaders, the religious leaders of that day. So did Jesus. His hometown essentially disowned him, and he lost his greatest ally, his cousin, his family, John the Baptist, to Herod's lust for a stripper. Even his disciples seemed to be growing at a snail's pace. And in a sense, they had been good children up until now. But as time, it was time to grow up, and they just weren't growing up. They needed to be adequately prepared for what was to come. And Jesus only had a year left with them. And so this is a big moment in Matthew's gospel. Soon his disciples, as we know, would be tested, their faith would be tested beyond what they could comprehend. And so we find ourselves at this turning point, this shift where Matthew begins to record a lot more of Jesus facing two things. First of all, he faced opposition, and second of all, he turned toward a specific ministry to his disciples. There was an urgency and a test to teach and to grow his disciples, to prepare them. Now, we pick up the story in Matthew after two important events that show the opposition to Jesus' ministry. He had been rejected, as we said, by his hometown, and he found that his cousin had been killed, John the Baptist, by Herod. And if you were here last week, you learned a little bit more about Herod, the tetrarch. He was the son of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, if you remember him, in the beginning of Matthew's gospel, killed all the baby boys that were in the town of Bethlehem after the Magi came through. And he learned that this coming king was coming. Well, his son had just killed John the Baptist, and he was actually the one who would eventually turn Jesus over to Pontius Pilate to be crucified. In fact, if you were to do a character study in the book of Matthew, just a study of the characters, you would find these two characters represent two contrasting kingdoms, right? One kingdom is ruled by the Herods. It's ruled by selfish, ruthless, insecure kings who maintain their power by murder and intimidation. They put their faith in their own ability to gain power and to maintain control. By contrast, the other kingdom is ruled by this humble king, a sacrificial king, and it's marked by those who are meek, who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and above all, who put their faith in Jesus as the Messiah. Our text this morning shows us what faith in Jesus can look like and how it grows. And it comes in two scenes. Let's talk about the first one. First of all, Matthew chapter 14, 13 through 21. I'll read it. The words are on the screen. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. John had just been killed and he heard about this. Hearing of this, the crowds followed Jesus on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food." Jesus replied, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. We have here only 5 loaves and bread and bread and 2 fish," they answered. "Bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 baskets of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So we see here, after Jesus hears about John's murder, and he leaves his hometown of Nazareth, he withdraws to a remote area, somewhere around the Sea of Galilee. It seems likely that he wanted to be alone to process his cousin's death, and so he leaves the crowds. It also seems likely that John's death gave Jesus a new urgency to train his disciples in the kingdom of heaven. It might have made his own pending death feel a little bit more imminent. The authorities were on to him. It was time to get away. Concentrate. It might be easy to pass over the details without reflecting on the humanity of Jesus during this time of life. Think about it. This withdrawal to isolation reminds us that Jesus is in fact human. He needed to retreat and to process the frustration and the sadness about John and spend time in prayer. I think it's worth noting there's not a human emotion that Jesus did not feel. He got angry. He was sad. He got tired. He loved and he lost. He wasn't a distant conquering hero. He was fully God and fully man. He was not partly one or the other, but fully both. And in all this, he made time to pray, because he needed to. You see, Jesus is showing his disciples something about faith here. Faith and trust grow out of a relationship. Like any relationship, the more attention it gets, the healthier it grows. Like any relationship that you and I have, it's the same way, right? You see, Jesus shows us that prayer is the seedbed for faith. Prayer is the seedbed for faith. In both scenes, you'll actually find Jesus, before he does any action, he takes time to pray. Not long after he seeks solace in this remote area, the crowds find him and come to him for healing and comfort. Matthew writes that when he sees the people, he has compassion. Now, the power of this word compassion gets lost a bit in the translation here from Greek to English. And so the kind of compassion Matthew describes here is not just sort of like a side hug compassion, you know? "Oh, sorry. Sorry, things are rough for you." It's actually the same word that Luke describes the father's emotion the moment he saw his prodigal son walking toward him. That's the kind of compassion Jesus has. It's a word full of emotion. Perhaps some of you in this room have experienced something similar to the father of the prodigal son. You've welcomed a child home who had been wandering. You felt that gut-wrenching compassion the first time they came home. Or maybe you're still waiting for a child to come home, and you feel that longing in your gut. Jesus has soul-moving compassion for this hurting, sick, broken, lost children who come to him. And so when Jesus looks at all these people who followed him out into the wilderness for comfort and for healing, he cannot help but feel compassion deep down. And the crowds came to this desolate place seeking a shepherd to lead them to cool water and green pastures. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it? Jesus heals the sick among them, but eventually, as the day wore on, a practical problem presents itself. The disciples come to Jesus and remark, "This is a remote place, and it's already getting late." They also have a solution, verse 15, "Send the people away so they can go to the villages to buy food for themselves." Seems reasonable. But Jesus responds with an odd statement. He says, "They don't need to go away." You can almost feel the compassion that he has. Don't send them away. You give them something to eat. It's actually emphatic there, the you. We might respond in bewilderment here, as the disciples probably did, but Jesus is trying to teach or reveal something to them. This miracle is one of a few that's recorded in all four Gospels, and it's all used differently, but Matthew records that after the gathering of the five loaves and the two fish that are collected by the disciples, he instructs the people to sit down. That's an important part. Sit down. Because that word is rather used as the word lounge, like at a banquet or a wedding. He instructs the people to lounge about. Think about what the disciples must have thought. Jesus, these loaves and the fish are not enough to feed all these people, let alone in banquet style, right? Why would you instruct the people to prepare for this great party, this great feast, to lounge around, and this amount of food wouldn't even give every person here a crumb? The loaves back then would be about the size of like a hamburger bun today, and the fish weren't exactly the size of tunas, right? The Gospel of John actually tells us that this was a little boy's lunch. It wasn't very much food. Clearly, it was a small amount, but that is the point. Jesus starts with a small amount. He then gives thanks for the bread and gives the bread and fish first to the disciples, and then they give it to the people, all 5,000 men, and probably, scholars think, another 10 to 15,000 men and, I'm sorry, women and children. The exact numbers don't really matter. The point is that Jesus performs a massive miracle with a minuscule amount. Jesus feeds all those who come to him. All those who trusted in him, they are fed completely. Now think of the contrast here to Herod, who had just killed John at a feast to feed his own lusts. At this feast, Jesus sets aside his own need to process and to grieve and provides out of compassion the real tangible needs of his followers. He didn't send them away, he brought them in. He then gave to his disciples the same task. It was as if he was trying to get his disciples to look at people the way he did, the way God looks at us. He was trying to show them something about himself as well. The Old Testament imagery of this scene would not be lost on any of Matthew's Jewish audience reading this text. Just like God provided Moses and the people of Israel manna and quail in the wilderness in a remote place, Jesus provides people bread and fish in this solitary place. You see, Jesus is both showing his disciples something about himself and something about his kingdom work. He took a small amount and did something miraculous with it. He did something miraculous because he's a compassionate king who expects his kingdom workers to be compassionate as well. I think this applies to his disciples, us, today. You see, the church that shows compassion on hurting, needy people, they will never be short of an audience, and they will never be short of supply. Matthew records that there are 12 baskets of bread left over. This could be seen as a minor detail, but the importance lies in the next scene. So let's go to the next scene. That was scene one. Let's go to scene two. Matthew chapter 14, 22 and 33 through 33. I'll read it. The words are on the screen. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on the mountainside by himself to what? Pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves caused by the wind against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come out to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why do you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So what's going on here? Well, the gospel writer John writes that the people were so amazed at the feeding of the 5,000 when Jesus fed them, the miracle that Jesus performed, that they marveled at Jesus as a prophet, and they actually wanted to make him king right there, king of Israel right there. Matthew did not record the reaction of the people, but he does write, immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side of the lake while he dispersed the crowds. That may seem like an odd thing for Jesus to do, but the phrase "immediately he made" is used in a way to suggest an emergency. Matthew means to say that Jesus was not just suggestive, but demonstrative that the disciples get in the boat and go away after he performed this amazing miracle. Perhaps the disciples got caught up in the hysteria that John describes, and they thought that this was the moment when Jesus would rise to power and they would ride his coattails to fame and glory. Of course, that just shows the disciples' misunderstanding of the role of Jesus in his kingdom and their role as well. The disciples get in the boat to continue on to their journey to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And meanwhile, Jesus disperses the crowd and stays on land to pray as the evening turns into night. Not long after the disciples push off from the shore, a storm develops. And it must have made the waters difficult to pass through because after a whole evening and night of rowing, they hadn't made it very far across the lake. They were some distance out, but not very far. The Gospel of Mark informs us that the disciples were straining at the oars for hours. This storm must have been incredibly frustrating, even to the fishermen. In a sense, they were caught in chaos, out in the middle of the storm. I think it's interesting that Jesus, who was able to see them, didn't go out to them immediately. Instead, during the fourth night of the watch, Matthew says that the fourth night of the watch, he went out to them, and that would have been sometime between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., so they'd been rowing all night, and he decides to walk across the stormy water to their location. If you remember, the disciples had already been in a storm with Jesus, but in that storm, Jesus was asleep on the boat, right? And when he woke up, he asked, and he was woken up, he calmed the storm, he said to the disciples, "You have little faith, why are you so afraid?" But Matthew doesn't record that the disciples were afraid for their lives in this storm. Rather, Matthew writes, and this is verse 26, when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, that's when they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and they cried out in fear. In this sort of story of chaos, they start to feel it. I don't know if you've ever been in a chaotic situation or what image comes to your mind when you're in a chaotic situation. Maybe it's like the 101 at 5 o'clock, you know? Or maybe it's your home in the morning trying to get your kids ready to come to church. That can be chaotic. But whatever the case is, In that culture, the ocean or the sea represents chaos, right? In a very terrifying kind of way. It was, in that culture, the ocean was seen as full of spirits that would sink and destroy ships and sailors. And think about it, they didn't have like aquariums or submarines or scuba gear, you know, to go out and explore the wonders of the deep. So the ocean, the sea was very mysterious. It was powerful, it was frightening. The sea could change quickly. It could swallow up a ship. It could toss and turn the strongest of man's efforts. I mean, these were, you know, fishermen out in the water straining against the oars. The sea represented all these things. It was chaotic. And then in the middle of the storm, they see something they've never seen before. Somebody walking towards them on the water. Even today, that would shock us, right? Oh, what is going on here? Absolute madness. And so they cry out, and it seems reasonable. Their fear comes upon them. But think of what Matthew just told us what happened. The disciples just witnessed Jesus multiplying 5 loaves of fish and 2 fish for thousands of people. And there was how many baskets left over? 12. One for each of them. And who told them to get in the boat? Jesus. Jesus emphatically told them to get in the boat and sail away. Jesus sent them into the storm. Was he really going to let an evil spirit sink the ship? Was he going to supply their needs in one moment, everything they needed, all this food and have abundance, and then abandon them in the next? What was he just trying to teach them here? What was he trying to show them? We read that Jesus tells his disciples to take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. That's verse 27. And then a character who Matthew has not yet recorded one word from so far speaks up. Good old Peter, my favorite character in the New Testament, besides Jesus. Peter replies, Lord, if it is you, tell me to come out on the water. Peter makes a proposition to Jesus, and Jesus tells him to come. And Peter got out of the boat and began to walk toward Jesus, and he saw the wind and the rain, and he was afraid. And Matthew tells us that Peter began to sink and cries out, Lord, save me! And Jesus immediately rescues Peter and says, you of little faith, why did you doubt? What's going on here? The answer comes in Jesus' choice of words. He says, it is I, right? In the original language, this statement is really, I am. The disciples, the original readers, would have understood what Jesus was saying and what Matthew was writing. In fact, this is what it would have read like in the original language. They said, take courage, I am. Do not be afraid. Does that phrase ring a bell, I am? It should. It's the same statement that God introduced himself by in the Old Testament. You see, this phrase is actually in the middle of the miracle, meaning that it's the point of Matthew's story. In a larger sense, it's the point of Matthew's gospel, isn't it? Jesus is telling his friends who he is. He's the Messiah. He is God. He's the God of the Old Testament. He's the one who provided manna for his people in the wilderness. He's the one who brought light out of darkness, land out of the chaos of the waters. And he's God with them now. He's the reason they do not need to be afraid. I am. So actually, when Peter says, Lord, if it is you, it's more like Peter is saying, Lord, since it's you. Peter, who represents the disciples at this point, takes a step of faith because he can no more walk on water than feed thousands of people with such a small amount of food. But he takes a step of faith. And no sooner does he get out of the boat into the chaos, into the wildness, than his faith begins to crumble. He takes a step of faith, and then all of a sudden, he looks at the waves, and his faith crumbles. He becomes overwhelmed, and he starts to sink. Peter, the rock, cries out, Lord, save me! I'm sinking! Peter means rock, and he's sinking. Okay, all right. Yeah, thanks. And immediately, Jesus does save him. And it's funny sometimes how a simple phrase can have such a profound meaning, but think about this. Isn't this the heart of the gospel right here? Jesus cries out what? Lord, save me. I mean, that's a gospel moment. Peter's faith is only that Jesus will save him, and Jesus does. For all of time, God has saved those who cry out to him with a simple cry, Jesus, Lord, save me. I'm drowning. I'm going to die. I can't handle it. The chaos is real. I'm in the middle of it. Lord, save me. And we see Jesus' response here, and we may think it's a bit harsh. I think if any of us would be afraid, I think any of us would be afraid if we were in that situation, the wind and the waves and the fact that we're walking on water. And Jesus responds, you have little faith. It's actually kind of a tender term here. It gets lost in translation. It would be better translated like little faith. Like child, come here. Jesus asks, why do you doubt? You see, the disciples didn't fully understand after they saw Jesus provide bread for the masses. They didn't make the connection. They hadn't understood up until now who Jesus really was. You might think to yourself, wow, if I had seen somebody take, you know, 5 hamburger buns and 2 little Nemos and feed Oracle Arena, I would get it. I would know that this was a God worthy of my worship. And Mark offers us an explanation of why they didn't get it. He says after this miracle of walking on the water, he says that the disciples didn't understand about the loaves or the feeding because their hearts were hardened. But I find it even more interesting that it's not in a moment of abundant provision that the disciples' hearts are softened to the point where they do get it. It's in the middle of chaos, the middle of the storm, that they cry out for Jesus to save them. Did you first cry out to Jesus to save you in the middle of a storm? Has your faith ever grown in the middle of a storm? Are you in a storm right now? Could it be that he has sent you into this storm to grow in your faith? You see, previously, when Jesus calmed the wind and the rain in the last storm, the disciples marveled and said to themselves, who is this man? They didn't realize who Jesus was then. In this current storm, Jesus gets back into the boat and calms the wind and the waves, and their answer is clear. So for the first time in Matthew's gospel, they bow to him and they worship him as what? As the Son of God. Matthew shows the disciples growing up. Who is this man? The answer comes now. He's the Son of God. And it serves as a mark of a growing disciple, doesn't it? Worshiping Jesus, trusting in Jesus, taking steps of faith, but putting our faith in Jesus. That's what it means to grow as a disciple. But perhaps you're like Peter or me. I mean, don't we vacillate and oscillate between faith and doubt? Do you believe that he died for your sins, yet you struggle to believe that he will provide for your needs? Do you believe that he is God, yet you feel overwhelmed by the storm that you find yourself in now? You see, Matthew's point is not that we need to be more like Peter and get out of the boat. Sure, God may call us to do some things that require faith. In fact, he always does. And Matthew's point is also not that we need to be less like Peter and not be distracted by the wind and the waves. Matthew knows that as a disciple, there will be times you're called to faith, and there will be certainly times that our faith fails us and we become overwhelmed. But of course, Matthew is not trying to draw us to Peter at all. He's trying to draw us to Jesus. The point is that Jesus takes a little faith, even faith that is riddled with doubts, and make it go a long way. You see, Peter would doubt again when Jesus needed him most. He would deny any affiliation with him 3 times. But despite the weakness of Peter's faith, the disciples' understanding of the kingdom, or the immaturity of even all of us here, Jesus redeemed Peter. He redeemed all the people who have come before us. He redeems you now, because it's not the quality of faith of your faith that saves you. It's the quality of the object of your faith. And the object of your faith is Jesus Christ. He's the Messiah. He's God with us. He's always been with his people from the beginning of time. He's always had that voice to us. He's always spoken to us through the prophets and through the priests and through the kings and through his disciples. You know, as I reflected on these miracles and I was thinking about chaos and what that looks like, my wife told me a very powerful story. She was training as a pediatric ICU nurse, intensive care unit nurse in the children's hospital that we were living in and when we were living in Philadelphia. And she found herself in a room of a baby who had been intubated practically since birth. Intubation means that there was a breathing tube down his throat, and the machine that the breathing tube was hooked up to had been doing the breathing for him most of his life. And the baby had spent months in the hospital, and his mother had practically lived in his room with him, always by his side. And gradually, the baby's health had improved, and he was breathing above the ventilator, meaning he didn't need its help anymore. But the medical team had already tried to make two attempts at taking out his breathing tube, and each time they tried to take out his breathing tube, things would immediately go bad. His oxygen level would start tanking, and the tube had to immediately be put back in. And they couldn't figure out why. And everything about the baby's breathing indicated that he should be able to do it on his own. And so now this is their third attempt. And someone got the idea to have the mother remain in the hospital room for the procedure. Now, taking the tube out required a lot of medical staff and was a very intense ordeal, and the mother had stepped out in the previous attempts. You can imagine, perhaps, a mother looking at their little baby having these breathing tubes taken in and out. How chaotic that must have felt. So here my wife was observing this final attempt, and a breathing monitor was put on the baby that would beep faster and at a higher pitch if his oxygen level started to go down. You can imagine hearing it, beep, 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 beep. Not good, right? And as the team began the procedure, the oxygen monitor beeped at a nice, steady, low beat. Beep, beep, beep. But just like the previous two attempts, as the team started to take out the tube, the beeping got faster and higher, and the nerves and the frustration rose in the room, and there was a lot of noise in the room. There was chaos. And at that point, a nurse motioned to the mother, and even though she couldn't be right next to the baby, as he was surrounded by doctors and nurses and a respiratory therapist trying unsuccessfully to force him to breathe, the mother came over, and she started to sing. She started to sing to him a little song. She sang to him a little lullaby that she'd been singing to the baby every day while they were in the hospital. And the beeping of the oxygen monitor got lower, beep, beep, and slower as the baby calmed down and began to breathe. In the midst of this chaos and the crowded room and the tense hospital, the mother's voice spoke to him, and it let him know, I'm here. I'm with you. You see, in the trials and storms of life, the broken marriages, the sickness that comes upon us suddenly, the kids who cause us heartache, I'm a youth pastor, I see that. The loss of a job and security, the unmet expectations and shattered dreams, Jesus comes to us with gut-wrenching compassion. And he provides for our needs, and he speaks to us in the storm. He comes to us who have so little faith and much doubt, and he takes whatever little bread and loaves we have, and he takes our weak attempts at walking on water. He comes to us, we who are so easily distracted, so hard-hearted, so feeble, so faithless, and he sends us out into storms at times, but he comes and finds us when we're helpless. And the Son of God, the Messiah, says to us, take courage. I am. It's me. I am here. And like a lullaby that rose above the chaos of the hospital room, it saves us. Like the bread of his body offered in abundance to you, like the hand reaching down, it brings life. While you may doubt, he never does. You see why Peter takes his eyes off and why we take our eyes off of Jesus and why our faith goes up and down and 5 steps forward and 10 steps back. Jesus never took his eyes off of Peter, and he doesn't take our eyes off of you, his eyes off of you. Let's pray. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, I pray that we would grow in faith and to do so, I pray that we would pray to you. We would cry out to you always. Bring us back continually to that simple statement, Lord, save me. Father, guard our hearts. Guide our hearts with that voice that you've given us that lets us know that you are here. You are I am. You thought of us before the foundations of the world. You have redeemed us on the cross. You have satisfied God's wrath against our sin. And a one-time event. It cannot be reversed. Thank you, Lord, for this week. I pray that we would go from this place listening to you as we walk in faith. Amen.